Hi, welcome to this week's program. I was thumbing through my emails the other day and I saw an article from Kiplinger Magazine, and it was basically an 8-question quiz to test your knowledge of the darker side of stocks, and specifically, particularly speaking about bear markets. So I thought it'd be a lot of fun to do this instead of my regular market commentary. And to this effect, I've invited my esteemed colleague, Rick Ditter, to join me. He's a senior wealth manager at United Capital. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for having me on.
First
time, man. Yes, it is.
I'm so happy to have you on.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
All right. So we've got 8 quiz questions. We'll see how good you do.
I can't wait.
We don't even know what's going to happen here. So question number one, why the heck do they call it a bear market anyway? A, bears sneak up on their prey and attack suddenly,
okay,
in the same way that bear markets feast on investors. B, the country's early bearskin traders would sell skins they had not yet received or paid for because the traders hoped to buy the fur from trappers at a lower price than what they had sold it at. Bears became synonymous with a declining market, kind of like selling short.
Yeah, absolutely.
And C, bears are notorious for ransacking campsites and stealing provisions in the same way bear markets can destroy your financial well-being.
Well, I could see that one too. And I'm just going to start off by saying I'm very glad this is multiple choice. It'll make me look a lot smarter here. Honestly, I think it's B. And I say that just because it seems like a very involved answer. So you really have to have gone to some lengths to come up with that. So I'm going to go with B.
Yeah, especially explaining that they'd sold pelts they hadn't yet paid for.
Right.
I mean, really? But you're absolutely right. The term bear market originates with pioneer bearskin traders. There's one other explanation, according to Wall Street lore. A bear attacks by swiping its claws downward, similar to the downward trend of a declining market.
Yeah, I'm not sure I buy that one.
I don't buy
that one. Yeah, I see the graphics on TV all the time with the bear claw swiping across every other week, but I'm not so sure that's
all right. Question number two. Stocks are officially in a bear market when, A, a broad market index such as the S&P 500 falls 20% or more from its peak. B, at least 2 major business publications proclaim a bear market on their magazine covers. C, stock prices end lower in the majority of trading days within a 90-day period.
Okay.
And D, the National Bureau of Economic Research declares it is so.
Well, I'm just going to have to say the magazine covers is clearly not the answer. Those are always way behind the times. And I think the same thing goes with D, the economic research.
Right.
I'm going to go with B. I've always heard 20%. You know, it seems like kind of an arbitrary number, but I'm going to go with, I'm sorry, that's A, answer A, 20% decline in the market.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely correct, though there is still some debate about whether certain downturns, like the one, let's say July 16th to October 11th, 1990, was officially a bear. So it says here, the S&P 500 fell 19.9% during that period. According to this publication, the average bear market decline in the S&P 500 since 1929 has been 39.9%. Now, that's not in a 1 year necessarily.
Yeah, yeah.
It could be multiple years, but the average decline. So that's kind of
peak to trough.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it does seem like you're kind of splitting hairs there with 19.9. It's kind of
a
debate of Pluto a planet or not, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You remember Reagan's phrase about whether you're in a recession or not? If you're employed, you're not in a recession.
Right.
If your neighbor is unemployed, then he's in, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think 19.9 is hard enough. But also, one other thing that this brought to mind was that I started the business in August of 1981 or so. And I remember that I think it was Fortune magazine had a black cover that said stocks are dead. Now, first of all, in publishing, you're never supposed to have a black cover. That doesn't sell anything.
Right.
And stocks are dead. And it turned out to be the absolute bottom of that bear market.
I love how the absolute declaration that they're dead is the absolute bottom of the bear market. That's perfect.
It's a contrarian indicator, so you have
to
keep your eye on it.
Right.
Yeah, so the idea that 2 major business publications proclaim a bear market on their magazine covers is totally lagging.
And that goes hand in hand with when the guy who drives the cab is telling you to go buy gold is not the time to be buying gold.
That's right. Bear markets, this is question number 3. Bear markets tend to occur once per decade, every 7 years, every other year, or every 3 to 4 years? What say you?
I'm going to say I've always heard 7 years kind of cycle, but it does feel like it's a little bit more frequent than that. So I'm not sure it's 3 to 4 years. I'm going to stick with the 7 because that's kind of the traditional along with the 20%. So,
well, a lot of things do kind of wrap themselves around the 7 years. I know that there's a biblical reference to 7 years regarding indentured servitude and releasing of debts and things like that. But no, It's not seven. It's actually every 3 to 4 years, bear markets tend to occur.
That's
according to Kiplinger, since 1932, bear markets have occurred every 3.8 years. That's 3 years and 9 months. And that which should give investors something to think about, considering the current bull market is now in its 10th year, which I'm taking exception to. First of all, March of 2009 is the absolute bottom, not October, as everybody thinks. But also, I think the market kind of had a heart attack.
Sure.
The economy had a heart attack. And it took a couple of years just to kind of get, I wouldn't even say to even, but just to get the patient sitting up.
Right, you know? Right, absolutely.
So it seems like, I think it's maybe 7 or 8 years at this point. Well, I don't feel like it's 10.
So are we going to, are we really going to count that first year or two when we're just trying to get back on an even footing as a bull market? I really don't think it's a bull market.
Yeah, but I don't think anybody cares what we think, you know. So let's go to question number four.
True.
Now, this is a good one. Which of the following is least likely to cause a bear market? Least likely, higher interest rates, rising inflation, sputtering economy, or military conflict or geopolitical crisis, least likely?
Well, I think that's hands down military conflict and geopolitical crisis. I mean, we have those going on constantly. I think you can look through history, you can find periods where military conflict actually spurs economic activity. And honestly, there is always some geopolitical conflict, whether it's a trade war or something else going on. I think the market largely ignores that. And that's a conversation we have a lot with clients is they're always very concerned when there's some news headline. But the reality is that there's always news headlines, and that is very different from economic news. Political news and economic news, there's a very clear divide between those things.
I think there should be an E here, and it should be tariffs.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one. I love it. Yeah. I'm glad you didn't throw that in.
So we know that higher interest rates, that's going to slow the economy down in certain circumstances. Rising inflation is always bad, and a sputtering economy, obviously. And you are correct, military conflict. You know, generally, you know, World War II, all of the great buildup of manufacturing, putting people back to work, that kind of took us out of the Great Depression.
Of course. Yeah.
All right. Question number five. You'll know a bear market is coming once an economic recession starts. True or false?
I think that's absolutely false. That one's pretty straightforward. The bear market always starts beforehand. The market is predictive.
Yeah.
The players in the market are always trying to anticipate. They're reading the tea leaves. So they're not going to wait around till the recession starts in order to sell down.
No, you're absolutely right.
That one's pretty easy.
Yeah. Okay. Question number six. The worst bear market on record was 2007 to 2009 when the financial crisis ushered in the Great Recession. B, the tech wreck of 2000 when dot-com stocks collapsed. C, the drawn-out decline from the start of 1973 or through the fall of 74, during which the Arab oil embargo sent oil prices soaring and the so-called Nifty 50 stocks sank. And Richard Nixon resigned the presidency.
All right.
That's C. We're talking about the worst bear market on record. And then the last answer is the one that began just ahead of Black Monday that precipitated the crash of 1929. We're talking about the worst bear market.
Yeah, I've got to think 1929.
That trumps
I think
all.
That's got to be it by hands down.
Yeah. Well, the tech wreck didn't last that long.
Right.
I mean, it was savage to those investors who were playing that game, and they just got wiped out totally. The 2007 to 2009, I mean, it was deep and steep and painful, but it was quick.
Absolutely.
Because the government just kind of injected all this capital into the system, and that helped a lot.
I think it was interesting. When we're reading the headlines, a lot of the things that the government was doing was looked upon as potentially dangerous or negative, and they really did learn a lot of lessons from the Great Depression that they put into play there.
Yeah. Well, Bernanke was an expert on the Great Depression, so the timing was right there. Question number seven, how long do bear markets last on average? A, a year or less, B, a minimum of 2 years, C, 21 months, D, seems like forever.
You know, D is very tempting. It does seem like forever when you're in the
when
middle of
it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I completely understand that. Yeah. But I think it is really shorter than what a lot of people believe. I'm going to go with my gut here. The first question we had, the precision of 21 months really rings to me.
I see. So. Yeah. So the average since 1929, rather, is 21 months, according to S&P Dow indices. All right, last question with my esteemed colleague, Rick Ditter. Which of the following is not a good investment for getting through a bear market? Which is not a good investment for getting through a bear market? Why don't we do this one together?
Let's do it.
Let's check them off together.
Okay.
Not a good investment. U.S. Treasury bonds.
Well, that seems pretty safe to me.
Yeah, so that's a good investment,
absolutely.
Right? Absolutely. Okay. High growth tech stocks with a broad following. Let's go to the next one. Classically defensive plays, including utilities, consumer staple companies, and healthcare. These are not good investments. I would say that is a good investment.
Yeah, I mean, right? It says defensive right in the name, so I've got to think we're pretty close on that.
And then not a good investment. This is answer D, gold or equities that invest in gold. So it's really between high growth tech stocks with a broad following.
Yep.
Or gold or equities that invest in gold. Which of the following is not a good investment in bear market? I'm going to say B, the high growth, because gold generally, if in a recession there's worry about the currency, the so-called paper or fiat currency,
yes,
there's always this move towards gold as a safe haven.
Yeah, okay? Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm going to take a little bit contrarian view there, and I'm going to say gold, because there was a tremendous amount of volatility in gold leading into the recession last time around. We saw dramatic drops in gold before it ended up going to $2,000 an ounce. It was incredibly volatile, and just for the point of most people think that they're going to buy this and it's just going to keep its value, people lost 30% of the value in gold before it came back up. So I'm going to go with D, and we'll see who's right here.
You're going to say gold?
Gold and equities that invest in gold is going to be my answer on this one.
As not a good investment.
Not a good investment.
Well, the answer is high growth stocks, high tech stocks. When stocks are in free fall and worries about the economy abound, there's nothing more soothing than full faith and credit of the U.S. government. Flight to quality, we did that. Broad-based indexes. Defensive stocks will lose in a bear market, but tend to lose less. And gold, which we recommend as a portfolio to diversify only in small amounts, zigs when the market zags. So anyway,
all right.
I guess, I don't know if we got the answer we're looking for there. yeah. One thing to know that I always remember about gold, people ask me, is gold a good investment? And I forget who said this. It may have been Buffett. I don't know. He said, you know, during Roman times, you could buy a great toga for now with an ounce of gold. And today you can buy a great suit.
How perfect is that? Because I've always heard people say it's a good store of value. And that's exactly right. So you can buy a toga today. You could buy a toga 2,000 years ago.
And it's still the one
ounce
of gold.
Yeah, the quote I had always heard, I think, was from Buffett, was the, you know, gold doesn't produce anything. It doesn't grow. It doesn't breed. It doesn't actually,
It costs you money to hold.
Right? Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Enough about gold. Enough about bear markets. Thank you so much for joining me, Rick.
Thank you for having me on.
To get in on the action, if you want to ask us a question about bear markets or bull markets or anything, don't forget to go to our website, stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update, which gives you a brief rundown of important topics that we've covered that week and straight into your inbox every single week. That's stevepomerantz.com. Are you anxious about your financial future? Have you ever made money decisions you've regretted and then repeated the same mistake again? Or perhaps you avoid talking about money altogether? Life is unpredictable, but your decisions don't have to be. And knowing where you stand and having an ongoing action plan will help you get where you want to go. So when you understand that the cornerstone of success is in making good decisions coupled with deliberate action, you can start on the road to ensuring that you're investing the way you should and feel good that you're taking care of yourself and your family in the best possible way. And you know, this has been the mission of the Steve Pomerantz Show from the very beginning. So once again, I want to remind you that you can ask us anything on your mind financially by visiting stevepomerantz.com. And if you have more serious concerns or questions, I'll personally take the time to get back to you to help you find a solution. I've been helping people do just that for 35 years, helping them get ready for retirement, save for a house or college, and so many of life's turning points. So once again, go to stevepomerantz.com and click on contact. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Investment advisory services are offered through United Capital Financial Advisors, a registered investment advisor. United Capital and the Steve Pomerantz Show are separate and unrelated companies.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Are the majority of Americans feeling their finances have or have not improved since the 2016 election? This is an important question we all want to know after 2 years of change. So I've invited Mark Hamrick, Washington Bureau Chief and Senior Economic Analyst for Bankrate.com, to join me today to discuss. Mark wrote for the Associated Press in Washington for nearly 20 years and is a past president of the National Press Club. Hey, Mark, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
To me, the burning question is whether the tax cuts or the other initiatives from this Congress and administration are having their intended effects. Are the majority of Americans feeling that their finances have improved since the 2016 election or otherwise?
Yes, thanks for asking the question. And obviously, all of that is tangential to the outcome of our survey. And I have some other things that I might add to those central premise. So our survey did want to know basically how Americans broadly were feeling about their personal finances now that we are 2 years since the past general election. And what we find is that only 4 out of 10 Americans say that their personal finances are better than 2 years ago. And the other part of the math is that 62% of Americans say their financial situation has not improved in the past 2 years. So we find it interesting that given the broadly positive headlines about the economy that we all write about or talk about or comment about on an ongoing basis, that the feeling essentially on the ground across the entirety of the United States, which is what we at least attempt to portray with a survey of this type, that as the saying goes, your results may vary.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's start with the big picture. Who are the haves and who are the have-nots? Let's start with, let's say, older Americans or lower earners, because I think if you break it down demographically, you can kind of really see where the gains are and where they're not.
Sure. Well, I mean, I can do it very quickly and broad brushstroke, and then if you want, we can go into more detail. But for the most part, wealthier Americans are saying that their finances have improved, and people who have less income, and by that definition here, $30,000 a year or less, are basically saying their finances have not improved. We have older Americans are saying that their situation is less improved, and younger Americans saying their situation is more improved. And then we basically have men saying their situation is more often better, and women saying their situation is more often worse. So a lot of people might want to know, well, how can this be, or why might it be, if you take the results at face value, which obviously we do, and we think that other people should. I think there are a number of possible explanatory factors, not the least of which is, to your point at the very outset, the personal income tax cut was favoring wealthier Americans. And there's a legitimate debate going on right now about whether it is even, frankly, even being felt by effectively the middle class as we speak. But you, of course, have other things going on, such as rising interest rates and certainly over the course of this past year, higher gasoline prices. Mm-hmm. We have a stock market that since Election Day 2016 has rallied quite strongly, obviously pulling back here in recent days and weeks. Obviously, that favors wealthier Americans as well. And even those people who are exposed to the stock market by virtue of their retirement savings, that is not liquid, right? So, I mean, unless you're sort of taking emergency measures to get at that money, which is not a good idea on a tax basis, you might have a sense that, hey, my retirement savings is doing better, but that doesn't necessarily help you to pay the bills. So I think those are some of the explanatory factors that why some of these results came up as they did.
Yeah. So let's get into that a little bit. So early on after the election, one of my comments and one of my commentaries was, right now, if you don't own any stock, go out and buy some stock, index funds, get some exposure to the stock market, because it was pretty obvious to me, at least, that that was going to be one area which was going to improve dramatically. There is this idea of the trickle down. When I was coming up in the 80s, there was a lot of talk about the trickle down economy. And I'm not really sure whether it ever really did trickle down or not. I'm not one to comment on that. I'm not an economist. But I think the bet here is that by giving high earners tax cuts, and companies, especially tax cuts, that would eventually lead to higher wages. Has it led to higher wages?
No, not substantially. The bulk of the benefit has gone to stock buyback. So that's great for investors. In a sense, it's great for corporations. Not so much for the average worker. And so, we've seen most of the incomes data or the wage data point to gains that have been either roughly at 2.5% on an annual basis or above that level. When you look at all of compensation, it's better than that because that includes some of the compensation that was doled out in the early part of the year, such as one-time bonuses. Mm-hmm. So my own opinion is that the wage benefits of the tax cut were promoted to try to make it politically palatable, because we knew, you know, from a broad standpoint, the notion of a corporate tax cut was unpopular with many Americans. Yeah. And so the idea to try to make it politically palatable to a larger cross-section was to say, oh, and there's an individual income tax cut as well. The reality of that, though, was that it did tend to favor wealthy Americans. So, you know, those are not philosophical arguments. Those are economically grounded arguments, as well as some observations about the political realities of all that.
According to the article, average weekly earnings rose by $53 from September of 2016, reaching $940 in September. That's a 6% rise. Sounds like a fairly decent bump, but I think you have to put that in contrast to higher prices from the tariffs and Canadian lumber and oil prices and so on. How easy is it to wipe out some of these somewhat meager gains?
Well, I think it's very easy. And, you know, we've seen this in years past where we've seen a spike in gasoline prices. We can think about things that were going on around the time of the financial crisis or that led into the financial crisis when we had oil at $140 a barrel. So when we look at, you know, other surveys that we do at Bankrate, you know, there's a surprisingly large portion of the American populace which is living paycheck to paycheck. Mm-hmm. And this is not something that is unique to this presidential administration or the last one. This is a long-term trend in the United States. So in a sense, it's an apolitical dynamic. And so, you know, we tend to lurch from one, you know, short-term solution to the next.
Yeah.
And the reality is that we have long-term structural problems that right now include rising debt, rising deficits, mm-hmm. as well as, you know, a middle class that is sort of not doing as well in terms of making as much progress as the upper portion of the income strata.
Well, I think the argument would be is that these things take time. Now, whether, you know, 2 years into an administration is enough time, I can't answer that. But, you know, it takes time for these things to filter into the economy. Now, the economy was improving for many years before the 2016 election.
Sure.
We know that we had, you know, the Great Crisis, the recession, and then things have been improving. The question really to me is, are we seeing an acceleration due to these tax cuts? Is the rate of change in people's pocketbooks better, or is it approximately the same?
Well, I mean, you know, we see measures of medium household income, net wealth, all those things are improving, but probably not to the level that broadly we would all like for that to happen. But there are some realities of the tax law that are sort of difficult to dispute. And part of those realities are that the benefits to the individual income tax payer or the wage earner were all front-end loaded. So here we are, you know, speaking, you know, in the closing act of 2018. And if you're going to feel that as a wage earner, you should have been feeling that for many months now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's a check that's still in the mail kind of a thing. The other part that perhaps you're referencing is the corporate tax cut. And yes, you know, there we're hoping for better investment in structures and in equipment that can lead to a productivity gain, which ultimately is a requirement for broader wage gains and improvement in our standard of living in the U.S. But even there, the jury is, I think, still out because of the factor that I discussed early on about how a lot of this has filtered back into stock buybacks. And, you know, that if you look at it just from the stock buyback piece, that's kind of a sugar high, right? Because, I mean, that's not going to help you in the long term. It's good for the coffers of a publicly traded corporation.
And shareholders, for sure.
Absolutely. You know,
and higher dividends are as well.
Diminishing them by any stretch.
Yeah.
But that's separate something that a worker gets, right? Yeah, and so
absolutely.
That's how we differentiate all that.
What fascinated me about this survey was how the differences of opinion split along party lines. In other words, everybody knows whether their situation is improving, is it worse, is it the same, yet their attitude or the way they describe their situation changes as to which party they're affiliated with. I didn't even really understand how that could be. Tell us just a little bit about that.
Well, without sort of, you know, raising too many digits in terms of our conversation here, I would just simply say that I think it's easy to sort of get at the demographics of members of political parties, broadly speaking. And broadly speaking, you know, Republicans tend to be better off financially than Democrats, you know, if you talk about sort of the broad brushstroke, but we know, for example, the counter of that is also, at least in some instances, true, where you have Republicans who've supported the president who might not all be of, you know, substantial financial means. But,
sure.
You know, I think, again, it goes back to the piece about, you know, who some of these policies are either helping or not helping. And, you know, if you're a beneficiary from those stock buybacks that we were just discussing, then you might tend to be a Republican. You might not be as often a Democrat, or you might be somewhere in the middle as an independent. And that's really sort of the way the polling broke down as well. So, you know, we're living in interesting times, as the saying goes. And, you know, some of the policies that certainly the Republican Party as a party have been embracing or at least enunciating, you know, are not necessarily traditional GOP policies. And so it's certainly understandable how a lot of this is difficult for people to process and digest.
Well, it's a weird tribalism that seems to be going on. Again, I think that, you know, it's a simple question. Do you feel better off or the same or worse? And what does it have to do with whether you want to kind of sugarcoat it as to kind of represent your own political point of view? I'm surprised at how much the political point of view came into the survey. Very, very fascinating. Mark Hamrick, Washington Bureau Chief, Senior Economic Analyst for Bankrate.com. Hey, Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you, and I appreciate it. And if anybody wants to read more about it, they can certainly find the story on our website or with a simple search. And, you know, there's more info there if folks want to see it.
Yeah, Bankrate is a great site as well. And to hear this interview again and any question you may have discussed, and of course, we will put the Bankrate.com link on our website as well. Visit stevepomerantz.com to join the conversation. And while you're there, don't forget to sign up for the weekly update for a brief rundown of the important topics we've covered that week straight to your inbox. And don't forget to ask us questions. We love questions. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky. Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Home prices still rising rapidly in a few Florida metropolitan areas, but...
but they are slowing down.
Sales are slowing.
They're slowing down.
Yeah. You're feeling it, right?
Yes, absolutely. And it's amazing how many people just still, you know, stop me in the street or, you know, people that I know and ask me about it because they're seeing it.
They are.
Because I haven't seen a whole lot of written articles about it unless you're,
either.
You know, in the regular newspapers. But if you're looking deep in the real estate papers, you'll see articles that are saying, hey, there's a shift coming. All you have to do is if you're in a neighborhood with for sale signs, look around.
Yeah.
You're going to see more and more for sale signs.
So the inventory, which you've been complaining about now for 10 years.
I know.
The lack of inventory.
It's healthy. We need the inventory. Yeah. So that's a good
thing. So inventory, but more people have their homes listed for sale.
Yes.
So inventory is loosening up.
Yep.
But the amount of buyers is reduced, perhaps. We don't know that.
Right.
For what reason? Why do you think there's a problem?
There's a rising interest rate.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, it goes for a while where they'll jump with both feet because it's rising.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm finding...
anticipating.
Right, anticipating. I better get in.
Yeah.
But I think, to be honest with you, I think they're thinking, oh, it's going to come back down. So I think some people might just be sitting there waiting. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, the whole interest rate thing has been crazy because we were, first of all, experts, quote, end quote, have been predicting rising interest rates, I think, for the last 5 years.
Oh, easy, yeah.
And I'm speaking specifically about the 10-year Treasury bond, which is kind of the bellwether for all this. And, you know, there was a point it was at like 1.8%, and then it was in the twos. And then it hovered around 2.75% for a really long time, and then it moved to 3. And it's like, okay,
this is
it. Start your engines, you know. So then in the last month,
right,
it went to like 3.25. And that's when all of these stories were coming out about rising interest rates and the higher cost of mortgages. Mortgages rose about a point and so on. But really, you know, October has been a very bad month for the stock market. And when money comes out of the market, it's got to go somewhere.
Right.
And it goes into treasuries. And a lot of that is in the 10-year treasuries. It drives up the price of the bond, which drives down the yield of the bond. So therefore, now rates are back down. So this idea about having rising rates that will affect the mortgage market, at this point, I still think it's a 50-50 possibility. It doesn't seem like the market is recognizing any facts which would tend to definitely make it go higher at this point. So my point is that mortgage rates have risen, but I can't really say for certain what the trend is anymore. They may have stabilized here.
It could be. And from my end, what I see is that, you know, the prices have accelerated and, you know, we've kind of peaked out. And so we're getting a pullback.
Yeah, you know, which is healthy.
With combination of the higher interest rate and the higher purchase price, it's starting to pull back. And the buyers are watching this. They're online. They're looking at the properties. Mm-hmm. They'll definitely pull the trigger if they see something that they like. But they're now starting to become a little more selective. So it goes back to condition. If you're going to sell your home in this market, as more inventory comes on, you need to be a lot more competitive.
Are we moving then to a more of a buyer's market now?
We're in a stable market. It depends on your price point. If you look at the market, just, you know, we're here in Boca Raton, but you look at the market over $1 million, it's very much a buyer's market. Mm-hmm. It's a stable market when we talk about the 5, 6 range.
500, 600.
Right, 500, 600,000. And then you take a property, say, at 350. I just put one on the market and I had 6 offers on it.
Yeah, because those are still pretty affordable.
They're very affordable.
However, we have some statistics here, which we were going to get to later, but I think now's the time. Typical monthly payments, well, let me put it a different way. It cost $118 a month more on average to buy the same house today than it did in 2017. That's a rise of 15.4%.
Which is a lot.
Yeah, so that's $1,200 a year or something like
that. Right, $1,400 a year.
Yeah, so that's pretty meaningful.
Yep.
That'll dig in if you're making $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year. That's another $1,500 that's out of your pocket.
Right.
Right. So there are numerous factors which are leading to this, but you've been in the market a long time, in the real estate market. For 30 years.
That's right.
So
I've seen several.
You've seen a few cycles.
Cycles.
As have I.
Yes.
In the stock and bond markets, right?
Now, this is not a bubble. This is just a cycle. And that's important to keep.
Well, we were talking about that before, because a lot of homes now are worth more than they were at the top of the last cycle. Like, well, I guess that was 05.
Right. 05. Yeah.
And now 10 years later, well, 13 years later, they're break even or better. That's not great.
Right.
That's for sure. But what's different is what was a bubble 13 years ago, now because incomes have risen.
Correct.
And just the cost of living generally has risen. In a sense, the inflation on the home has not.
Has not increased
so
as much.
So now all that other stuff's catching up with it. And that's the way markets work.
That's right.
That's what they work.
Yep. So it's a healthy thing right now. Depends on what side of the coin you're on, if you're a buyer or a seller.
Very true. As always the case. All right, so we're talking about a slowing of the sale of homes. What is the prediction for, if you're a general contractor, or the degree or the rate at which people are going to be remodeling their homes now?
Sure. Well, when you think about it, when you're getting ready to put your home up for sale, a lot of remodeling is done then.
Yeah.
And then when you move into a house, a lot of remodeling has been done then. So the contractors have been extremely busy. But the projections are for 2019, we're going to start to see that these guys are going to slow down quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So, if you're in that business.
Well, there's not much you can do, but at least be aware.
Be aware that
there's. Or up your advertising and get a little bit more market
share. Right, take over market share.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's the time to make your move.
Okay. Smart lady. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. And she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, PomeranZ.com. You're listening to the Steve Pomeranz Show. As we impose tariffs against trading partners who aren't playing fair, my next guest reminds us that America's role in the global ebb and flow of goods is hardly innocent. In his new book, Black Flags, Blue Waters, The Epic History of America's Most Notorious Pirates, he recounts the scoundrels who terrorized the shipping routes in the Atlantic and Indian Oceans, unnerved the superpowers of the day, and ultimately reflected the brash of the new nation to come. Eric J. Dolan is the author and my guest. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Before we talk about the pirates and the business that they did in with the colonialists, let's talk about piracy itself before that. In the 1500s, Spain and England were mortal enemies, and there was some state-sponsored piracy as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. In the 1500s, starting in the late 1400s, you know, Spain sort of took over a lot of the Western Hemisphere, and they felt that it was their domain. They also found great wealth there in the mines and mints of Central and South America, and a lot of European powers, including England, were quite jealous of all this Spanish success. So Queen Elizabeth I, the Virgin Queen, ordered one of her men, one of her sea dogs, Sir Francis Drake, to go to the Pacific Ocean and attack Spanish galleons and hopefully relieve them of their treasure so that some of the wealth that Spain had commandeered through its conquest of the West could come back into English coffers. And Sir Francis Drake did an excellent job. He overpowered and plundered a number of ships, came back to England, where he was knighted for his heroics. Mm-hmm. He wasn't treated as a pirate by the English, of course. They viewed him more as a privateer. But the Spanish, of course, viewed Sir Francis Drake's attacks as pure piracy. And in fact, at the time, England and Spain were nominally at peace. So Sir Francis Drake was more of a pirate than he was a privateer. But Queen Elizabeth was quite happy because the amount of money and treasure that he brought back was almost the equivalent of a year's worth of the income from the royal income. So it was really a great win for her, and Sir Francis Drake was treated as a knight. And it's basically true throughout history that nobody is called a pirate unless their fellow peers call them so.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is in the eye of the beholder. Sure. Depends on whose ox is being gored.
Yeah. One man's ceiling is another man's floor. You know, it's just the way, way it works. Now, a century later, the British colonial governor of Jamaica hired another famous sea captain, Henry Morgan, and turned it loose on the Spanish possessions. So I know that he was also very, very successful. And they did this, these states did this under the guise of letters of marque, if I'm saying that correctly. What is that? What were those?
Well, letters of marque are basically privateering licenses that during times of war, a government is legally allowed to issue a letter of marque to a merchant ship, an armed merchant ship, that gives them permission to go out and attack the enemies of the country during the time of war and bring back the ships that they capture and have them adjudicated at admiralty courts and actually get part of the profits from those ships and perhaps get the ship itself. So Henry Morgan was a buccaneer. He was a pirate for some time, but also he did get privateering licenses, and some of them were issued during times when Spain and England were at war. Others were issued at times when that delineation was less clear and his acts were more piratical than privateering in nature. But it's important to point out that the line between privateering and piracy is often quite thin. Mm. And many privateers veered into piracy, especially since both groups have the same set of skills.
Let's fast forward to colonial life in America in the 1600s. First of all, what was life like, let's say, for colonialists in the Northeast and Boston? And like, what was the actual living conditions and the difficulties they were facing under British rule then?
Well, it was very difficult. They were on the edge of empire. Here they were hugging the coast of the American colonies, not getting a lot in the way of support from the mother country, certainly not having any representation in Parliament or the affairs of the mother country. And England really looked at their colonies, not only their American colonies, but their other colonies, as ways to enrich the central powers. Mm-hmm. So the Americans were feeling a little bit left out and condescended to. And they also had a very difficult time getting currency, with silver and gold. And they were often forced, and they were in fact forced by the British government, to pay for a lot of their goods with currency. Yet the colonies were often starved of the very thing that they needed to enrich their own lives. And also the navigation laws required that all goods coming into the colonies had to first be transshipped through England, and that entailed additional customs duties, right, and made many of the products more expensive. So it's no surprise that many American colonists, even in the late 1600s, well before the American Revolution, were feeling somewhat abused by the mother country. And they had good reason for feeling that way.
Yeah. And so they were in kind of in desperate straits. So here come the pirates now, who are kind of knocking off all of these merchant ships and other things like that, and then bringing that money and that booty to the shores of this young, early pre-country. And they were getting the money they needed. They were getting the goods they needed. And I understand from your writing that, you know, Boston and Newport had the banks with the best skilled money launderers and also some of the best prostitutes and grog houses in the world. So there was more. There were more attractions to bring in those pirates.
Yes, yes. The colonies did compete to give higher rates or fees, sort of laundering foreign money or Spanish silver dollars. And so the pirates could get more bang for the buck if they went to certain colonies. But one thing that's really important to mention in connection with the piracy that took place in the late 1600s, much of it was American ships with Americans on board, people from the colonies, going around the Cape of Good Hope into the Indian Ocean and attacking Mughal or Muslim ships coming from India that were transiting to the Red Sea and the ports of Jeddah and Mocha. And they had plenty of treasure on board. And one of the things that made it easier for Americans at the time to accept this form of piracy, even though those Red Sea men were given privateering licenses because it was during King William's War and France and England were at war, those privateering licenses were basically just covers. They were not privateers. They were pirates going into the Indian Ocean. But what they were doing is they were plundering these quote-unquote infidels or heathens halfway around the world and bringing that money back to the colonies. So the colonists, who often labeled these Red Sea men as privateers, even though they weren't, didn't have any compunction against supporting them,
yeah,
because they were attacking people that they looked down on anyway. And then they were bringing all this great stuff back to the colonies.
Yeah, I mean, they were the heathens. They didn't care about,
yes,
the heathens. They were less than human.
Right.
So they didn't really care. I mean, that kind of the way it kind of juxtaposes the fact that, you know, New England and Boston, it was really kind of very ruled by the kind of a Puritan autocratic kind of government and morality. And yet in this case, you know, I guess they looked the other way. As a matter of fact, John Winthrop was described a 1646 visit by pirates to Plymouth as divine providence. And actually, I went online and I find they're still celebrating that today in Plymouth.
Right.
Every year they have a celebration. Yeah.
It seems throughout history, one of the things that's really fascinating about pirates and can be reflected in so many elements of American or world history is that money talks, and money often persuades people to view similar situations quite differently, depending on whether or not they're benefiting from the money,
yeah,
or they're the ones being attacked and being plundered. So the colonists really had no problem with this money. And even though perhaps it didn't square with their religious morals to some extent, they were willing to accept it. Later on in the 1700s, when it was the colonists and their interests that were being attacked by pirates, they were singing quite a different tune. But again, greed and money determined the course of American history and world history very strongly.
Yeah, and I don't think things are much different today. As a matter of fact, we see very much the same parallels between the kind of the have and the have-nots as well.
Absolutely.
My guest is Eric J. Dolan. The book is Black Flags, Blue Waters, The Epic History of America's Most Notorious Pirates. We don't have that much time, but I was interested in the surprising way in which pirate ships were governed. How did they manage their own affairs?
Well, they were largely democratic in nature, but don't confuse them with being sort of political philosophers.
Yeah.
Basically, what they did is they drew up the articles of the ship, or the pirate's code, as it was called. And in that, it would determine how the money was split. And often the money on a pirate ship was split almost equally, with the captain and the quartermaster and perhaps a medical person, if he was on board, receiving a little bit more. The pirates also had the opportunity to vote for who would be their captain, where they would go in search of prizes, and which ships they would attack.
Right.
And along with this voting ability for their captain, they also could depose a captain who they felt was not doing a good job. And that happened quite a bit. So yes, they were democratic in nature, but it was really because they were a floating society and they needed to establish rules that would make them become a cohesive fighting and threatening force. And you have to keep in mind, many pirates mutinied on merchant ships, killed their despotic captains, took over the ship, and launched into piracy. So it makes sense that those very people who had been lorded over by one individual would not want to recreate a system on their pirate ship where there was too much power concentrated in the hands of one man. So that was in large part the reason why they voted their captains in and then voted their captains out.
Yeah.
So it is a fascinating floating society, but again, don't draw any parallels between the democratic principles that the pirates had in the early 1700s and the democratic principles for which the American Revolution, or on which the American Revolution turned.
Well, these people were ruthless. They were scoundrels. They didn't mind killing and stealing and doing what they needed to get what they wanted. So I don't think I will confuse them again by using democratic principles and opining on that. We have a lot of myths about pirates. For example, Robert Louis Stevenson in Treasure Island wrote of buried treasure. Was there ever any buried treasure?
There is no record of any pirate during the Golden Age burying their treasure. They often spent it as fast as they got it. And just think about it. If you bury a treasure, that implies that you're going to be able to get back there sometime in the future. And that was not necessarily guaranteed.
Yeah.
Also, if you buried your treasure, somebody else might find it. And they liked to keep the treasure nearby, and when they had opportunities in ports of call to spend it, they did.
Yeah, so there wasn't really a culture of saving.
No, they weren't good money managers.
No 401ks there.
Yeah, the few pirates that got a lot of money, and I have to emphasize that it was a few. It's amazing how many pirates really failed to achieve much in the way of wealth, but the few that did manage to get their hands on a lot of money often didn't do very well with it over time, if they even survived.
Not surprising. So why are we so enticed by these kinds of images, whether it's the Western gunslinger or the Prohibition-era bootlegger and the pirate? You know, we've got these dashing leading men, Errol Flynn so many years ago, and Johnny Depp today. I don't know how dashing he is, but he's different. The bottom line is, why are we so attracted to these people? Is it because they go against society?
I think that's certainly part of it. The allure of reading about people that do things that you in your own life would never even consider doing, and sort of the abstract notion of being in control of your own destiny. For a pirate, going out in the ocean, being on a ship with other men, drinking rum, plundering at will, and hopefully living a long and a fabulously wealthy life. Now, unfortunately, the reality of it was nothing like that.
Well, most pirates didn't really make any money.
Right. Oh, most pirates not only didn't make any money, they lived relatively short lives, and many of them found the end of their life at the end of a rope, being hanged.
Yeah.
So Another part of it is what you mentioned, Hollywood, Errol Flynn. I mean, the leading men, the rakish rapscallions, the good-natured thieves on the ocean. Those images that we've seen in so many movies starting in the early to mid-1900s have had an indelible impact on how we view pirates. And then there's some other thing. You'd have to talk to a psychologist to get the answer to this, because I still am puzzling about it. But why do people love reading about the bad boys and girls of history, people that do horrific things, you know, be it a murder mystery or a war or something else, things that are really wrenching, difficult to read about, and that you probably wouldn't want to be involved in, nevertheless create such a compelling narrative that people are drawn to it. And I think pirates benefit from that to some extent. And it's exciting to dress up with a patch, an eye patch, a hook for a hand, which is another myth, and go around saying arg and matey.
What about wooden leg? Not many wooden legs, I understand.
I came across no
wooden leg.
Pirates with peg legs. However, there were men at the time, sailors, who had their legs blown off by cannons that did get prosthetics that were in fact wooden legs, as well as claw hands. Yeah. But, you know, it's difficult being on a ship when you have two good legs and two good hands.
Yeah,
imagine the difficulty getting around without that.
All right. Well, the book is about pirates. It's Black Flags, Blue Waters, a great little book, The Epic History of America's Most Notorious Pirates. And I think the bottom line here is to remember that money and greed, and rather than the many lofty ideals that we would like to believe shaped the expansion and the success of America, rugged individualism, things like that, which of course did exist, but equally so, or to a great degree so, money and greed also had a lot to do with that. My guest, Eric J. Dolan. And to hear this in any interview again, or if you have a question about what we've just discussed, visit our website at stevepomerantz.com to join the conversation. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update for a brief rundown of the important topics we've covered that week straight into your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com. Eric J. Dolan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Listen to this title: Irrational Exuberance and Neural Crash Warning Signals During Endogenous Experimental Market Bubbles. Huh? Well, I recently came across a rather interesting piece of research from Caltech, and even though that paper has that geeky title, it's really about an experimental study to discover warning signs of irrational exuberance and the resulting crash that could occur as market bubbles start to form. And thankfully, the paper's findings have been nicely condensed in layman's terms by Kim Fessenmeyer of Caltech. In their experiments, Caltech's researchers studied the brain activity and behavior of people trading in experimental markets where price bubbles were artificially simulated and endogenously created. Now, endogenous in this context means without any outside interference. So they hooked up electrodes to traders' heads and watched brain activity and behavior as stock prices rose to levels that were well above fundamental value to see how these experimental traders reacted as prices rose, as stock price bubbles formed, and then burst. On analyzing this experimental trading data, researchers found two distinct patterns of brain activity. One small fraction of participants got early warning signals from their brains that made them feel uncomfortable and urged them to sell, even as share prices were rising. The other, much larger group got brain signals that made them behave greedily, buying aggressively as stock prices rose and even after they have peaked. Researchers found that the lucky few who received early warning signals and got out of the market early earned the most money, while the larger group displayed what the former Fed chairman Alan Greenspan called irrational exuberance, and they lost their shirts. The researchers also saw a market bubble form without outside hype in the experiments. There were no television sets with talking heads hyping up their various views on the market, just experimental traders in a room reacting to rising stock prices. So a bubble formed without any outside hype or misinformation, which was a bit of a surprise because generally the market wisdom mostly attributes bubbles to external type or other external factors like TV and all this information and the puffing up of bull markets and the like, but they found that really wasn't true. Researchers also conducted another experiment. They divided participants into three groups based on market earnings, low, medium, and high, and found that low earners tended to be momentum buyers who started buying as prices went up and kept buying even as prices tanked. Apparently, they were hoping to make money on a bounce back or trying to lower their average purchase price because they bought when shares were peaking. Medium earners were those who played it safe, did not take too many risks, and neither made nor lost a lot of money. And the high earners were the traders who bought early and sold stock when stock prices were on the rise, above fundamental value, but well before they peaked. So, these high-earning traders emotionally did something that was really hard to do. They sold their shares in a rising market because the region of the brain that deals with risk aversion sent out strong early warning signals to the small fraction of high earners. So, this neurological experiment by Caltech researchers confirmed Warren Buffett's advice to investors, which is to be fearful when others are greedy and to be greedy only when others are fearful. It was that risk-averse fear signal that caused high earners to pack their bags and get out of a rising market. They did not stay in, they didn't get greedy and try to maximize their gains by timing the peak. They simply got out while the going was good and therefore came out ahead. The study also confirms something that experts like Buffett and Howard Marks, who I've quoted many times here on the show, keep saying. It's about playing not losers tennis, which means you should make non-speculative investments and manage your portfolio in a manner where you're pretty sure that you're not going to lose your investment capital. So the high earners in Caltech's experiment were those who focused on protecting their gains, and the ones who lost were greedy and wanted to maximize their trading gains, and in doing so, got burnt. I often say that if you invest in stocks, you should know what you own. In this case, I'm going to add to it the ancient phrase engraved on the temple of Apollo in Delphi, Greece. The inscription counsels us to first know thyself. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Malzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.